right. Good morning, everybody. I'm doing a special quick one-off interview with Jacob Magid, who is U.S. Bureau Chief for Times of Israel. And I had an interview a few days ago with Mikhail Hauser Tov that I liked very much. We don't get, for some reason, like direct answers to the most logical reactions that we have to the news stories. So I figured I could contact some of these journalists directly. So first question is, because I know you don't have much time, and this is the toughest question of all to ask, has Israel been using hunger as a weapon in this war?
I don't think it's doing so intentionally. And I think intent is a factor in some of these legal decisions when they're coming to the International Court of Justice and other places. However, I do think as a result of a lot of the decisions that Israel's making in a more pinpointed manner and looking at specific convoys that it's blocking from reaching the northern part of Gaza, which is really, according to international experts, is suffering or either looming famine or Samantha Power, the head of the USAID, Agency for International Development, said a few days ago that they already are experiencing famine. Moves like restricting convoys from coming in, which we saw twice on Friday, all of Saturday, that obviously impacts us. That this is their opportunity to get food, and if they're not able to get it, obviously there's going to be repercussions on their state. Israel says that it's limiting these convoys possible for small periods of time, sometimes entirely, but it's because of kinetic ac military activity happening in the areas where the convoys would like to go. But unless it's trying to open up other routes, as it has sometimes, to get more aid into northern Gaza, it's kind of ultimately responsible for what's going on there. Do I think it's doing it maliciously? Is there a cabinet meeting where they're sitting and saying, okay, we're going to limit this amount of food in order to win the war? Because we know the weaker the Palestinian population gets, the harder it is for the it more puts, I guess, Hamas into a corner in negotiations to a certain degree, even though we've also seen that Hamas doesn't typically care for Palestinian civilians. But I think so. No, I don't think those discussions are being had. However, as a result of a lot of these decisions that Israel set, a lot of them bureaucratic, not all of them malicious, though some of them are. We've had very serious situations where the humanitarian situation in Gaza has gotten so bad, and I think that's what led the Biden administration after this World Central Kitchen strike to kind of throw the towel and try a new approach with Israel, which is much more pressure oriented. And then we've seen some results in the past few days.
So, I mean, you could imagine, this is so difficult to talk about, but you could imagine behind the scenes saying, listen, we have to feed these people, but we also want to pressure them to, as you said, to release the hostages, to rise up against Hamas, whatever it is. And then I could see that starting as something that was just harsh and then very easy just slipping into something that was inhumane as humans just get used to things and things take on a life of their own. And that's what's always been worrying me here. On the other hand, and I'll ask you to respond to this, everything leaks so quickly in Israel, even the most confidential conversations. That part of me says, you know, somebody would blow the whistle on such an outrageous strategy. You could not find 10 Israelis to all sign off on that, I don't think. So, what's your response to that?
I would agree. Israel leaks. I don't cover as closely other governments around the world as I do Israel's, so I can't tell you exactly how other countries work. But it is shocking to see, like in real time, in some of the highest, most classified meetings, in real time, you'll see leaks come out from the ministers themselves, passing along recordings, passing along quotes to their spokespeople, who then issue press releases or just issue those statements. And I think they all each of them want have an interest of trying to look tough or just look a certain way in these meetings, and they use the leak as the way to do so. It's kind of just done quite egregiously. So yes, in that kind of construct, you're not going to see a whole group of ministers getting together and say, okay, we're going to use famine as a war tactic. But I mean, in the beginning of the war, there were statements put out by the Defense Minister Gallant, the then Minister of Energy, Israel.
Yeah, I actually have it here. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant on October 9th said ordered a complete siege of the Gaza Strip, saying there'll be no electricity, no food, no fuel, everything is closed. And then on October 16th, Ben-Gvir said that no way should enter Gaza as long as Hamas held hostages. Now Gallant, that was a temporary thing. If you look into it, then a few weeks, that was initially Gallant said he never meant. I mean, there's so many angry statements that came out in those first couple days. Just as an aside, I had a an employee who got slashed on the subway, and it elicited in me kinds of anger and things that I was ready to say that I didn't know I had in me, just in the way I felt about the people who did this to him. And it was just a it was it was like an insight into some way what the anger must be on both sides. If anybody who deals, I'm not speaking just for Israel here, for the Palestinians as well, the kind of visceral reaction you have to this kind of violence towards you, your family, your people. You have to give a little latitude, I believe, to angry statements, especially in the moments right after. I know people don't want to hear that, but I give that same latitude to people on the other side. In the end, it's got to be the person's actions that they're judged by, I believe, their policies.
I agree. I think we're in this absurd reality where Israel's being brought before the International Court of Justice for probably fighting a war not drastically differently than a lot of other countries have, but somehow finds itself singled out and facing some of the most serious crimes at the most heavy tribunals. But once you're there and once you recognize that you're at risk of being put in places like this, I think leaders have a responsibility. It's not just the man on the street that's being slashed. It's actual people who are elected to public office that have a responsibility, regardless of how unfair these allegations might be. To even if there weren't any allegations, I think leaders have a responsibility to, especially when you're waging a war that does have such a high civilian casualty count. The reasons for that we can get into, but still, to be sensitive to the fact that what you say matters and people are watching, and you don't have necessarily the right as a public official to just
Oh,
speak your mind.
I
Like,
agree with you. I agree. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I agree with you 10,000%. I was struck by the lack of professionalism, not so much by the far right crazy, but by Gallant. I understand the emotion, but you're the defense minister. You can't. But the American presidents say dumb things too. So now on the question of the aid, going back to what you said before, you had a headline: Israel says Kerem Shalom crossing blocked by undistributed aid waiting on the Gaza side. So that, and that, this was, I think, your byline. This is kind of the opposite of what you're saying. It says that aid is just piling up, and not being distributed. Is that true?
So this was more recently, the past few days. What we're looking at is after Biden kind of slapped Israel for really not doing much over these past few months, that Israel whipped into shape, recognized, okay, this is different. He's actually serious right now, and started inspecting trucks at Kerem Shalom and Nitzana, the two crossings where it does inspections, and then they're moved to Kerem Shalom or to Egypt's Rafah crossing, but everything goes to one of those two crossings. And was doing it at an incredibly fast pace, expanding the hours of those operations. There's been a lot of criticism of Israel keeping them closed on Shabbat and holidays, and it sounds like they'll be changing that policy at least to a degree. And was able to get in over 400 trucks on average for a few days last week, and I think now we're down back to closer to 300, but still far far more than what we were seeing during the war. We had 100 trucks a day less. There were 50 trucks a day for a long period of time. So these numbers were massive. And when those numbers were lower, though, we had enough trucks inside Gaza to be able to distribute all those aid packages that were just sitting there on the Gaza side of Kerem Shalom. But once we had such an influx, there haven't been enough trucks in Gaza because once it's a very tricky system, it's incredibly convoluted that the aid has to change trucks like three times throughout the whole process for various bureaucratic reasons, both on the Israeli side and the UN side, who require all these different steps. And there just aren't enough trucks in Gaza. Right now, there's a scramble with the UN and international organizations to try to pay for a contract, large amounts of trucks. I think I understand over the weekend there was significant progress on this, and there'll be more trucks coming into Gaza, but there's still the UN and the US and Israel's also urging countries to donate trucks, and they're hoping to see that number expand significantly in order to pick up all that aid that's just been sitting there on the Gaza side and distribute it throughout Gaza. That has become the new biggest issue. I think interestingly, I spoke with you, David Satterfield, the US humanitarian envoy. He said there's not really like a one side to blame on this specific issue. The UN is maybe more responsible for this next step of trying to find more trucks, but Israel needs to also approve all of them and give them permits. So everyone's involved and everyone's gonna have to step up. But right now, I think unfortunately, we're still in this blame game where each side loves to just tear into the other for being responsible for the lack of aid reaching Gazans.
Now, what do you know? Oh, actually, let me just go on. I'll come back to another question. What do you know about the actual situation on the ground in Gaza? Now, before the war, we would hear articles, see articles quite often about food insecurity in Gaza, risk of famine in Gaza. So this is not completely new, although I'm sure the accusations are much more intense. We see from time to time, like Christine Amanpour tweeted out a picture of a child, emaciated child in a hospital bed, which obviously could be from famine. On the other hand, I have to say, there's something incongruous about seeing this starving child surrounded by, perfectly healthy looking people. How is it that these people are even plump, and yet this child doesn't have food to keep her not emaciated? So the question comes to your mind, am I seeing what they're purporting to show? Is there good evidence of famine in Gaza? Also, I just say on Morning Joe there were reports of people grinding up dog food, just horrible things. But there's a PR war going on. So what do you know about what's true and what's not?
Look, I'm not in Gaza, so obviously my understanding of what's going on there is quite limited. I do trust certain sources that are coming out of there, and I have contacts within the UN and the Israeli side and US officials who are on the ground and also foreign diplomats. So I do feel like I have a decent understanding, but it's limited. I think we're not at the stage where the hunger is or famine might be widespread, but I do think there are certainly like these images I don't think are being doctored to the degree of what the question is whether they're likely a lot of these kids are suffering from diseases already. And then due to those diseases are once coupled with lack of hunger, they're suffering much faster than other people. And I think that's when you're seeing these totally emaciated kids. It doesn't necessarily start with the lack of malnutrition, but it because it exists after the fact, I think it's exacerbating their situation. And then we have had situations where kids have died. But is it the original cause being hunger? I'm not sure. But I think that the concerns are not just in the UN, it's also US. And I think it's interesting that even US officials now are saying that famine has started in certain areas. And I think there's this off effort by Israel to say no, that there's enough food and water going in, and we have pictures of these markets that are selling food and they're full of food. But I think those aren't necessarily the best barometer to tell how much food is in Gaza because those markets are often prices are being jacked up. People can't really afford to buy things in those places just because they're operating is only a limited picture of what you're getting there. In southern Gaza, though, where the vast majority of Palestinians are, there aren't those kinds of reports. I think the way the U.S. Envoy for Gaza Humanitarian Affairs said it is that they're getting the bare minimum to not starve. So there's not famine, but there is food insecurity, and the health and sheltering conditions are quite miserable, as he said. So that those are, the, I mean, so wherever you go, be it northern Gaza where it's most serious and where they. I guess you could argue that the IDF did give people warning to leave that area at the beginning of the war, and these are people who stayed either because they refused the warning or simply couldn't get out. I think not everyone had the means to be able to just get up and leave. Older people, weaker people among them probably weren't able to. And ended up staying, and now we're looking at like 300,000 Gazans in the north, and then the rest in the south, most of them congregating around Rafah. And you can imagine just the conditions of stuffing 1.4 million people into such a small area.
Well, and it should be mentioned, not that I'm trying to be an advocate, but I think as a it just it would be mentioned in any news story. Hamas urged people not to leave. Hamas had roadblocks.
Exactly.
I mean,
Thank you for pointing that out.
it's a relatively small area. I mean, you could walk from the northern tip of Gaza to the southern tip of Gaza in a day. So that always gets lost, and some of these other distances are walks of hours long. So at some point, just there's a certain common sense that says, well, if my grandmother were 9 miles away, I would walk with her. I'd get her there. If I thought she was going to die, I'd put her on my back. I would manage. So, I'm just skeptical. Listen, by doing this interview, it should demonstrate to people, this is trying to defend myself here, that I'm trying to not be afraid of the facts and not be afraid of the truth. But I don't want to, at the same time, give up my right to say certain kind of common sense defenses that occur to me that I don't hear anybody commenting on. Sometimes if you talk to an American who's slightly informed, they think that these distances are like, you can't, ex how are they ever going to get out there? Well, it's actually just 5 or 6 hours walk. It's not, you're not talking, how, could you get from the tip of Manhattan to the other tip of Manhattan in, if you had to get the hell out, over the course of months? Yeah, you could, unless people were trying to prevent you. So, and that's what I'm worried about. And let me just say one other thing while I'm kind of putting things on the table here that might mitigate the blame. In 2 seconds, if you Google what happened in Iraq, you'll find headlines like Iraq war is blamed for starvation. Acute malnutrition among Iraqi children aged under 5 nearly doubled last year because of the chaos caused by the US-led occupations, the United Nations experts said. And so there is a part and parcel problem of this kind of thing in what seems to me wars. And having said all that, this is the one area where I really demand that Israel do everything that it can, both because it's the right thing to do and because it's so damaging to their war effort. Nothing is more undermining Israel's support here than the notion that they're starving children. And again, and it's the right thing to do, and for Jews especially. I mean, and I imagine most Israelis would agree with that, no?
Yeah, I think we're seeing slowly shifts among public opinion to not be as opposed to this idea of aid. I think there's an understanding that this isn't really the bargaining chip in negotiations and for the hostages that we might have hoped it is. I think Hamas has its demands that are more related to allowing Palestinians to return to the north. I think they're very, very concerned about a Nakba, and that's why you mentioned where they are trying to pressure people not to go follow the IDF directives and go south, because they know that right now that the potential for Israeli settlements in Gaza, it would be in northern Gaza. And if you leave northern Gaza, leave it empty to Israeli settlers, I think there's going to be attempts to reoccupy those areas in civilian fashion as well. I think that those are still fringe voices in the government, but they're in the government and do have impact. I think these people are preparing for the moment where they're going to be trying to go into northern Gaza to reestablish settlements. And I think Hamas very much wants to prevent that from happening and keep people from leaving the north. So I think that's something really to be taking note of.
All right. Is there anything else that you feel people should know about this aid issue before we leave it?
Look, I think I was definitely interested in this question of who's responsible, because you just see these tweets from Kogat, the Israeli quasi-military authority who's kind of responsible for the aid facilitation, and then the UN of just like trading blame between the sides of Israel's responsible for not approving enough trucks, the UN's responsible for not distributing them. And it took me months to, and I think it's still up in the air a little bit, to try to get an understanding of what's the actual situation. And I did feel that the more I learned, the more I realized that it felt like a lot of the backlogs were a result of Israeli steps. But there is responsibility on the UN side that hasn't been highlighted enough, and I think has to do with like just the lack of distribution. They're obviously working under incredibly difficult conditions. I don't think anyone would really be wanting to be responsible for trying to figure out how to get aid throughout Gaza when the desperation is so high. But there are things that could be doing better on the distribution front that could have been preparing for this situation where they needed more trucks at an earlier period, but they also would have needed Israel to approve these trucks quickly. And that's not something that Israel's been proven to do over this process. So I do think there are multiple sides involved in this kind of failure. And as Jamie McGoldrick said, who's the outgoing UN humanitarian coordinator for Gaza, he said that it's a collective failure. And that's something that I think a better way to look at it is a collective failure as opposed to trying to just single out Israel. But if you do look into some of the details, there is a lot of problems with how Israel's been managing the situation. It's understandable. We're in a war effort. Things are crazy. But it has helped me at least to get down to specifics to understand what's been going on and why things have been so bad for so long. But hopefully these past few days, the moves that Israel took to open a pair of crossings, hopefully those will be open soon. One of them has in the northern crossing that's been opened. I think Ashdod still has to be opened as well. But hopefully that when in the pier as well, I think we'll see the surge of aid that we've been calling for, or a lot of agencies have been calling for months.
And to the extent that Israel's hopping to it now because of the pressure from the American administration, one cannot fault the American administration for having done that, right?
Right. And I think, unfortunately, it gives a lot of credence to those who are saying the only way to get through to this Israeli government is through, like, really just a lot of pressure, like saying enough is enough. I think Biden, on his phone call on April 4th, basically put it bluntly to Netanyahu, we can't continue to support this effort, this war effort. We're gonna have to consider very much changing our policy in this war if you don't take significant concrete steps that are implemented on the aid issue. And then within hours, Netanyahu managed to do something that he wasn't willing to do for months. So it's unfortunate that now you have a lot of credence to those who say the only pressure works with Israel. I'm not sure if that's really the case, but there you do have a pretty strong argument from last week.
And if he wasn't willing to do it to months, it does imply some sort of intent. Can you, or just at least a lack of concern, I don't know. Can you give us any insight? They always talk about Netanyahu, but then from time to time you hear savvier people explain, well, it's a war cabinet. And Netanyahu is not in charge the way a commander in chief in America is in charge. And actually, his main opposition, the people most likely to take over the government if he after an election, are also there making decisions with him. So to what extent does the blame for any Israeli policy have to be spread among the entire unity government? And how much is to be blamed on Netanyahu, the evil Netanyahu?
Yeah, exactly. I think most decisions are within the framework of that are made are within the framework of the war cabinet, of the government backing it. There are obviously tactical moves that are conversations that Netanyahu himself has alone with world leaders. A lot of the flip-flopping that Netanyahu does on decisions, like with Rafah, where he talks about that we're going in, I have a date. And then last night, my understanding, in a private meeting with the war cabinet, they kind of canceled it for now, given what's going on. So all of, I think his public, that kind of shtick, this never wanting to make a decision, making agreements with Biden about allowing him flour and then taking months to implement them after his other ministers blocked those efforts. I think you can blame Netanyahu, but I think it's such a lazy Netanyahu's war term that's being used by progressives in the on Capitol Hill to just try. It's I think it's more politically palatable to call it Netanyahu's war. They did it with Putin and Putin's war in Russia, so now they're doing it with Netanyahu's war in Israel. Totally misunderstanding the fact that this war is being widely supported by the Israeli public, is being widely backed by the war cabinet. It's just pure laziness and a lack of understanding how Israel works, and just it's just about trying to, I think, appeal to a base where people may be not totally comfortable yet, even though these circles, I think they are probably pretty comfortable with just saying Israel. I don't think I don't think they look at Israel any more highly than they look at Netanyahu at this point. But there are some and parts of the Democratic Party who are more uncomfortable with just calling it Israel's war, being critical straight up to Israel, as opposed to saying Netanyahu, who is undoubtedly a less popular figure and someone they can get behind criticizing. And that's what you're seeing a lot of these folks do in the US. It's quite interesting that the scope that it's taking place. Jamal Bowman, less the New York representative last night, I saw tweeted about Netanyahu's war and callousness after the Iran strike, not mentioning the Iran strike. It's just like a total la la land some of these lawmakers are in, trying to appeal to their bases, but not even understanding what's going on the ground, or willfully ignoring some of the facts of that are happening. Again, Netanyahu obviously has agency, and I think the biggest frustration among Israelis is that he's refusing to take any responsibility. It's like beyond insane that you could have something like this happen, and the leader indisputably is behind all of it, regardless of he knew there were failures on the military level. But at the end of the day, you're in charge. There's a phrase right now, "Ata ol shata Hashem." You're at the helm. You're responsible, and Netanyahu does not see himself as responsible for what happened on October 7th, and only for the good things that happened since. And I think that's frustrated a lot of Israelis, but that's a different angle of this make of blaming him than what we're seeing on the left in America.
Because I don't want to run out of time. So just I would tell you, Yair Lapid had a long tweet yesterday where he almost sounded like Netanyahu, you know. So you people should look it up. Two more things quick, and one actually one question, then I want you to tell me about the Iran strike, which happened yesterday. There is it reminds me of Trump. That if you don't like Trump, you can't give him credit for anything. You know, they call it Trump derangement syndrome. And just as a guy who's, I'm not pro Netanyahu, I don't know enough about Israeli politics to be pro Netanyahu. But I do notice certain things that correlate to Netanyahu's regime. One is that Israel's very wealthy and able to afford a lot of armaments and technology, and is a completely different place than I knew 15, 20 years ago when I was young. That seems to be very good, and Netanyahu is part of that story, and Israel would be in a much worse situation if not for that. And I noticed that the Arab world came to help Israel yesterday as these missiles and drones came in. The Arab world. And this has to be credited to Netanyahu as well. He saw that these alliances were possible while the American administration mocked him. Am I wrong for giving him credit for those things?
Well, it's tricky. You say the Arab world was helped in the strike and intercepted some of the missiles. From my understanding, right now, the only country that I've been able to confirm that took part in this was Jordan, and
But
that wasn't.
wasn't Saudi Arabia also involved in helping with the, we
That
saw?
happened. I would love to have the exclusive on that, whether that's actually happened. I know that for example, there were reports that the UAE had also participated, and that I was able to confirm was not true. I spoke with some pretty senior Emirati officials. I'm looking into the Saudi angle of this as well, and it's possible that they did contribute. But the main country that I think made the most headlines, in addition to the US, the UK, France, and others, was Jordan. I think that was what was so fascinating, seeing how furious Jordan is over Israel's conduct of the war, and still deciding to help Israel. Obviously, I think there are reasons that it has on its own right to want to take part in this. I think they don't like the idea of having foreign countries' drones flying through their skies that puts their own citizens in danger. They don't even want, I think, these drones managing to strike in Israel and killing lots of civilians. I think that causes regional unrest that bubbles through into Jordan that's not to their benefit. And I think the relationship between Israel and Jordan is really quite nuanced. You have a lot of animosity, especially during wartime, but even afterwards. But at the end of the day, they do recognize that they do have these strategic interests. And I think because Gaza, what happens in Gaza maybe kind of stays in Gaza, as my brother mentioned when I was talking to him about this, that but if something were happening in the West Bank, where Jordan really sees that area as much more existential. If there was a mass migration of Palestinians from the West Bank into Jordan, I do think we would have might not have seen Jordan take the steps that we did that it did take last night or 2 nights ago. But I think yes, it's definitely a change. We have an opportunity right now through this strike to demonstrate or to really solidify this new umbrella defense cooperation between some of these regional allies, even ones that might not have participated, but would be willing to, because I think this really does draw a line in the sand of where which side you're on. Is it this with the Iranians or with the West-backed or the US-backed Arab alliances that also get help from the US, can also get help from the UK and France? And I think it's clear that a lot of these countries that you mentioned, whether they did participate or didn't, do want to be part of this, but it's going to require, as they say, some sort of cooperation from Netanyahu and the Israeli government on the Palestinian issue. And I think they're saying that over and over again. We're willing to cooperate with you. We're willing to make normalized relations with you, Saudi Arabia says, but we need to see some sort of progress, some sort of horizon created for a future Palestinian state. It doesn't have to be created tomorrow. It doesn't have to be all of the West Bank, without any settlements there. It doesn't have to be the perfect state, but it needs to be something to give the Palestinians hope so that we don't need to continue having these wars every few years and then being asked to fund the reconstruction of Gaza or the reconstruction of other areas because we know that those buildings are just going to be blown up because the conflict isn't being solved, it's just being managed. And that's been Netanyahu's MO for the past few decades, is managing the conflict.
Right. Not, I mean, that's a complicated issue. Maybe we have another conversation. My suspicion is they don't expect actually the Palestinians to accept these things, but they expect Israel to offer them in good faith, at least that they can tell their citizens, that Israel is playing ball. I don't expect the Palestinians to accept anything. Hamas is not going to accept.
I think once Saudi Arabia gets actually involved in this and they have their credibility on the line, I think there's going to be a lot more pressure than what we've been seeing on the Palestinian leadership. Like on previous peace negotiations between Israel and Palestinians, there was nobody really doing this. In 2008, Olmert and Abbas got further than probably anyone has gotten, and Abu Mazen just didn't answer, inexcusably, wasting away what probably was the best opportunity the Palestinians would have to have the largest state that we're going to get, and we're everyone's facing the obviously it would have been tricky. Olmert was on its way out due to corruption charges. Maybe it wouldn't have panned out anyway, but that was an opportunity right there that the Palestinians just totally squandered, and they're not going to get anything nearly that good since. But I think if you have a player on the Arab side sitting behind Abu Mazen saying you're not getting off this table unless you take something that we think is reasonable, I think that could change the dynamic of the talks. And I think that we'll be in a better position to reach some sort of agreement. But of course, we're so far away from this.
Yeah, there's one thing I believe, and then I'm going to just ask you to tell us what you want to tell us about Iran. In my soul about Israel is that if you say it wouldn't maybe wouldn't have panned out anyway, if there was a real peace offer that was real in the way Sadat's offer was known and seen to be real, I would stake my life and my family's life on it that Israel will embrace it. I do not believe there is a majority of Israelis who would turn down a two-state solution if they believed it was really the end of the conflict. I think a huge number of the people who oppose it say, you're going to get us killed if you accept this. Not that they don't want it. That's my strong belief.
I think that has long been the sentiment. I do think that we have seen a shifting in political discourse and political opinions in Israel further to the right as a result of the intifadas that I
Right,
think
but
have.
that's my point. They, because of the Intifada, not because they don't trust it.
But
They trust it less than ever.
I think people are at this point are it's not just a trust. I think there's a belief that the more land you have, I think does give more security. I think those people have reached parts of government and that they have real influence over, and I think it shows that the sentiment is strong in Israeli society. So I'd like to think that yes, the majority still believe that if something was on the table that was genuine, they'd agree to it. But I think there's a growing amount of people who are of the more religious types that I think are deeply believe that any sort of compromise is not something that they can live with. And I think having covered the West Bank and seeing the demolitions of like 9 homes that were built illegally, and seeing tens of thousands of people come up and try to to prevent those demolitions from moving forward. The idea of having to do that for thousands of homes, let alone like way more than that, which might be necessary, is to me mind-boggling. I don't really see how that could work out. But again,
No,
great
they're going to have
things
lands.
can
They're
happen.
going to have, as they propose, land swaps
Right.
for
There will
instance.
be land swaps, but there will be certain places that will probably have to be moved, and
Yeah.
that's going to be tough.
It's going to be awful, but I just don't want people to think that. I mean, you said it in your answer that people feel that they need the land for security. If only they didn't feel they needed land for security, you'd be stuck with these religious fanatics, and that would not be enough to control Israeli policy. I mean, as it is, the Israeli elections swing on a tiny sliver, and that's without a good faith offer from the Palestinians. Anything you wanted to, I know you had a hard out at 8:30, it's already 8:32. Anything you want to tell us about the Iran thing, including were you in Israel while it happened? Oh, you weren't.
Oh,
Well,
sorry.
including what you were feeling, anything you want to tell us about the Iran strike?
Sure. I'll go to the response. I think, I mean, it's a phenomenal success for Israel's, as far as Israel's concerned. And speaking with, I was on a White House briefing last night about just like the extraordinary success that this was. I think there was a period in time where there was real concern about whether, when you, it's one thing to prepare, for this kind of thing, but 100 ballistic missiles fired at once, you don't really know exactly the success rate of that's going to be. And I think there was some tense moments in the Situation Room, tense moments in the War Cabinet Room in Tel Aviv at the Kiryat, waiting to get those results. But phenomenal. Without putting any, I don't know, without diminishing the horrible tragedy of this 7-year-old girl who was seriously injured from shrapnel from an intercept, and also that we also had this base in Nevatim, with the main Air Force base in southern Israel nearby, that also was minor damage, but that was it pretty much. That's pretty shocking when a country fires 300 drones and missiles at you to only come away with that is pretty remarkable, and it's a testament to the obviously the Israeli systems that have been put in place, years of, I think, support for these kinds of technologies. Who organizations like APEC, who I think were really lobbying for some of this military defense, that came to bear this week, and then looking, because it was so successful, that I think in the amount of help that the U.S. gave Israel, with half of those drones being basically shot down by the U.S., the commitments between other countries that were the U.S. helped build, were also involved. So major player here for helping stop this attack. Obviously, the majority of the ballistic missiles were shot down by Israel, but and I think that Israel has a bit of an open checkbook to the U.S. right now, and I think it's why we haven't seen some rash, immediate Israeli response. And I think Biden really wants to keep this from becoming a full-blown regional war, and that is why I think we haven't seen some major Israeli response yet. I do think it might come eventually, but I think the response that might win the day for now is that we're gonna write this down and we'll respond at a time and a place of our choosing. And I think keeps the Iran on its toes, keeps the diplomatic international community, I think, in Israel's camp right now, which is a rare moment right now where Israel isn't being demonized. I think it's seen as the victim in this scenario and seen as acting responsibly, trying not to escalate the situation further after such a horrendous attack. There's concerns, I think, amongst the right in Israel that that shows weakness and that the Arabs only understand force. I hear you kind of hear those arguments, or the Iranians only understand force. But for now, I think if they wait for a specific time of the choosing, I think they'll be able to keep the Biden administration on a bit on more in their camp after quite a few weeks where those ruptures in the relationship between the US and Israel were getting quite stagnant.
If there were a referendum tomorrow on whether the Israeli people wanted their government to address the missiles in the north and get rid of them, or to kick the can down the road another 10 years like they have, what do you think the answer would be?
So okay, I haven't seen polling. I don't think anyone's done polling this quickly yet. I tend to think, speaking to people there, that there is some comfort in kicking the can down the road right now. I think the Israeli people are quite going through 6 months of war right now. We're quite traumatized, and there's also recognition that this strike does put off, to a degree, the hostage negotiations. And I think that is the issue that's most salient for most Israelis right now, is getting those hostages home, knowing that every day their lives are at further risk. If there are many of them are even still alive,
Right.
and just moving attention away from Gaza to Iran does not benefit the hostages and the efforts to get them released. So I do think that I don't think there's this cry from the majority of Israelis right now, we have to respond, we have to respond. The success of this, the results of this, that nobody except for one person was injured, are enough of to go off of to maybe, okay, let's put this in our pocket for now and we'll deal with it in a time and place of our choosing.
All right, sir. Are you in New York? Where are you located?
I'm currently in Chicago.
Well, if you get to New York, you should come down to the Comedy Cellar and
Yeah,
hang
which
out with us
neighborhood?
there. A lot of interesting people hang out down there. All right, I want to thank you for your time and for your good work. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Noam. Good
Bye.
talking to you. Bye-bye.